Welcome. I'm Sebastian Mahfood, and you're listening to WCAT Radio, the on-air wing of En Route Books and Media, bringing you the dulcet sounds of Catholic wisdom with our host, Bob Olson, who will now introduce today's show and speaker.
Hi, this is Catholic lay evangelist Bob Olson with I Thought You'd Like to Know This Too, which is the Friday edition of I Thought You'd Like to Know This, which features interviews with very interesting people who have a message for you. And today we have with us Kevin Simmons, who has written some terrific books, and we're going to talk about a couple of them tonight. So welcome, Kevin Simmons, to our program tonight.
Good evening, Bob. It's good to be with you this evening.
So I'd like to begin by finding out a little bit about yourself, about you. And were you a cradle Catholic, by the way?
No, I am actually a convert Catholic.
Okay.
I became Catholic in... Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. So you became Catholic?
Yeah, in 1997, officially.
Okay.
And it's been a wild 20 years now, 20 years, the 29th of March.
Wow. Well, see, I go way back to 1981, so.
That's the year I was born.
Okay, that's interesting. All right, so a little of your background. How were you raised?
Well, I was raised in a Unitarian community up in Massachusetts, just outside of Boston. And we weren't much of church-going people. I remember going to Sunday school maybe twice. Not to say we didn't go any other times, but that's just the time that I remember. But other than that, I don't really, we really weren't much church-going people at that time.
Where'd you go to school then?
I went to Franciscan University of Steubenville in Ohio for both my bachelor's and master's degrees. I graduated in 03 with the bachelor's and 06 with the master's. And the degrees were in theological studies and a background in the classical languages during my undergraduate years.
So you were a Catholic by that time then, huh?
Yes.
So how did that happen? How did you become a Catholic?
Well, it all started with my father falling down a flight of stairs in October of 1994. One day he was going up the stairs, and he lost his balance and fell back and snapped into the gutter. And shortly thereafter, he went on a lot of medical issues, and as he was going through these, some of his extended family was coming onto the scene a little bit more, and they were Polish Catholics, and they would talk to me about all things Catholic faith, and I became interested, so I just started picking up books or reading things, and my mother had a coworker at the time that was also a practicing Catholic, and my mother had somehow brought up to her that I was looking into this. I don't remember exactly how that all went down, but she had given me some materials as well, and one thing led to another, here we are.
Well, by the way, you probably knew that Father Scanlon died on January 7th.
I did. Requiem Scotum Patri, may he rest in peace. He was a dear man. A lot of people owe a lot to him, myself included, particularly because of the household program at Franciscan University.
I know, I know.
It's just a wonderful, wonderful man. Even if we didn't always see eye to eye on things, but I was looking at some pictures on Facebook and seeing him laid out in a casket in the same place we saw him at the altar and then at the podium there. It's just total difference. It's like shocking, you know.
I know.
I felt bad that I couldn't make any of the services, but nevertheless, we pray for him.
Well, tonight we're going to talk about this book, Refractions of Light. And Amazon says, for the past several decades, there has been a notable rise in claims of apparitions, visions, and messages from heaven. This growth has often led to confusion and sensationalism among the Catholic faithful. Refractions of Light, 201 Answers on Apparitions, Visions, and the Catholic Church, seeks to address this situation using an easy-to-read question and answer format designed for a broad audience. It does not shy away from controversial topics, reaching into the relevant church documents which it includes in its appendices to address them. Kevin Simmons' book is a must-read for anyone seeking to understand how we come to know when heaven is reaching out to us. So let's talk about this book. Very interesting. Let's see, the first question that we have is, what is private revelation?
Private revelation, in a nutshell, is all of those supernatural communications that God has given to people since the close of the New Testament, which is traditionally held to be the death of St. John the Apostle around 100 A.D. It is connected to that larger revelation of God that we call divine revelation, but the words private revelation more or less refer to that continued intervention of God in human history done on more of a private level as opposed to that public level. It's a theological distinction that the theologians and the church have made, but nevertheless, it's very, very, very helpful to make those distinctions.
So what does the church teach on the topic?
Private revelation is viewed by the church. She always wants to listen carefully to the voice of her bridegroom speaking to her in every age. So she's open, but cautious. Probably the best way to express this. The church knows that there is the spiritual world and and the communion of saints, but it's not always easy to tell, to pay attention to the signs of the times, so to speak. And so the church is open to these communications from God, but she has to make sure that they are in fact coming from God. And so we enter into that discernment if somebody claims to be receiving a revelation from God. So she doesn't view it as being good or bad, strictly speaking. It's more about she looks at it from the perspective of, is this God speaking or not? Sometimes somebody just misunderstands something and there's no malice involved. It's just very simple, very straightforward. So open but cautious is the best way to address that specific question.
Well, we've been taught in Charismatic Renewal that if you have words from the Lord, that you usually introduce it by saying, I think this is what God is saying, not making a definite statement like that.
Yes, and that opens up the cautious element, that element of caution
mm-hmm.
there. But biblically speaking, St. Paul says that you have to have, for instance, with the gift of the extraordinary gift of tongues, you have to have the interpreter there. And when it comes to discernment, very rare do you have somebody who has the gift of the discernment of spirits themselves, like St. Paul did in the book of Acts, I think it's chapter 16, where there's that the girl who had the spirit of divination. And St. Paul, after constantly hearing her say, these men are from God, these men are from God, he turned around and gave her an exorcism on the spot, commanding the demon to leave her. But yet, she wasn't saying anything that wasn't untrue. She was actually saying, listen to these men, they're from God. But St. Paul knew that this was not the Holy Spirit. He knew it was a demonic spirit saying this. So, again, it was just enough truth mixed in with a lie. And St. Paul had that extraordinary gift to be able to see right through the disguise and just say, nope, boom, out. Very rare do you come across people that had that specific gift. And so the emphasis has shifted towards the role of the pastors of the church, the Pope and the bishops and the priests, in guiding people towards discerning these on a more, almost more personal level, not quite in a charismatic context, for lack of a better expression. But the charism of the church, insofar as our authority is concerned, is kind of more or less now how these things are, how these issues are addressed.
Now, should private revelation be made the center of our faith?
No, absolutely not. Not whatsoever. The object of divine and Catholic faith is Christ himself and and as God has revealed himself through the first the prophets and then the patriarchs and prophets and then in the person of his son. That is the locus, the place of our Catholic faith. Private revelations assist the words of Cardinal Ratzinger, that they help, that they are a help to that faith, but we can never substitute our divine Catholic faith for a private revelation.
Now, to what documents can a person go in order to learn about private revelation?
There are many documents from the Church's history that discuss these affairs. The more recent one that was issued by the Vatican came in 1978. It was called Norme Sacrae Congregationis, Norms of the Sacred Congregation. It was issued privately to the various ordinaries, privately in order to help them discern, so that a case Joe Schmo or Jane Schmain came up and said, God is speaking to me. He wants me to give this message to the world. They will have, the bishops have some guidelines, some criteria to go by in order to effectively discern these particular claims. Even though it was issued privately, in May, on or around the 23rd, I think it was, of 2012, the Vatican then published them at large for the faithful, to for everybody to read. So now it's a matter of public record.
So what are some of the famous private revelations in the Church's history?
There's Lourdes that have happened in 1858, I believe. The Rue de Bac apparitions in France in 1830. La Salette apparitions as well, also in France. I think it was in the 1840s, if I remember correctly. You have Pontmain in Belgium in the late 1800s, 1880s, 1890s, maybe 1870s, somewhere in the latter half of the 1800s there. Fatima is probably one of the most famous ones that occurred in Portugal in 1917. Then there's Borang and Bano, also in Belgium in the 1930s or thereabouts. Yeah, those tend to be some of the pretty big ones, and they're usually, in the more contemporary period, it's the Blessed Virgin Mary appearing to one or more people and communicating to them some warning or something along those lines, in order to help the faithful to live the gospel in a particular moment of history.
Now, how does the Church discern if an alleged private revelation is authentic or not?
In this case, we go back to that document that I mentioned earlier, the Norms of the Sacred Congregation. She has various processes that she goes through that have been fine-tuned throughout the past 2,000 years, this document being just one reflection of it, and has actually, in fact, has much greater meaning against that big tradition there that's behind the document itself. First of note is the Church talks about the levels of authority that these claims go through. So let's say I claim that the Virgin Mary appeared to me and has a message. I would properly first speak to my local pastor. If I have a spiritual director, I would definitely talk to my spiritual director. And if after listening to my claim, they would talk to me further and discern these things, if they felt as though that something was serious here, they would bring it to the attention of the local bishop. And it would then go to the bishop, and if it warrants a full investigation or examination of the facts, the bishop can either examine things himself using some criteria that is mentioned in the document, which we'll get to in a moment, or he could request the professional assistance of theologians or psychologists, medical professionals, various people of learning and education in those specific fields. If, for however it happens, through some fact of happenstance, the claim gets bigger than what the local bishop can handle, he can then turn and ask the local episcopal conference, nation's bishops, to help him discern the claims in order to render a safer judgment or a more sure judgment on the matter. And if still the claim gets even bigger than one's own country, it could then possibly go to the Holy See in order to reach a judgment. Now, those are just the levels of authority, and there's kind of nuts and bolts in between some of the finer nuts and bolts there. But as far as the various criteria that are used, the Church sets out positive and negative criteria. So some positive criteria, for instance, are things like, just generally speaking, does this person go to Mass? Are they living a normal life of prayer? Are they psychologically balanced? Things of that sort. Some of the negative criteria, are they imbalanced? Are they crazy? Have they done psychotropic drugs? Or are they involved in speed dating at the time of the events in question? So if I'm alleging to be receiving visions from the Virgin Mary, but meanwhile I'm a sexual profligate, the Church will look at that and go, no, we don't think so. That's not the way these things operate. But that's a different story than, let's say, I did drugs at 20 years old, let's say, and I cleaned up my act, and for 10 years I've been clean, and I claim to then have a vision. Yeah. That's a little bit different story. The church looks at that a bit differently. So she makes a final point to say, at the time of the events in question, is there immorality or something psychologically wrong there?
No. Do you have any examples of any of these that have gone all the way to the Holy See?
Positive ones are, Fatima has been endorsed by the Holy See. I believe
okay.
Lourdes has as well. Fatima, I think, though, is probably at the top of that list. The Golden Rose, the traditional gift from the popes for a very serious reason to, like, a church or to some mm-hmm. person. The popes have sent a couple of Golden Roses to Fatima. There have been some bad ones that have also been sent to Rome. Not bad ones, excuse me. Some not approved ones. Right now,
yeah.
Probably one of the biggest ones is the question of Medjugorje. That Rome has
yeah.
had a commission about 7 years ago. It'll be 7 years now this coming March. And its work ended in January 2014, and we are currently awaiting the Holy Father's judgment on the results.
What do you know about the first one in the U.S. there in Green Bay, in the Green Bay area?
That's where I live, an hour and 10 minutes away from there. That was approved by the local bishop, David Ricken, of the Diocese of Green Bay. It was not formally approved by Rome, but I can tell you from inside information that the bishop brought things to Rome and said, this is what I'm thinking of doing. Just wanted to keep in the loop. The Vatican, I think, looked at everything and said, hey, you know what, if you're good with this, go have fun.
I didn't realize how that happened.
Yes. The bishop didn't have to go through Rome, but again, it's always good to keep Rome in the loop just so that you have a safer judgment on the matter. And I know Bishop Ricken did, in fact, bring it to their attention, and he had no problem with his decision.
And you've been there, obviously, huh?
I volunteered there for about a month in June of 2011.
Well, the Fathers of Mercy still there?
I believe so. Father Stryker, I think, is still there. I don't remember who his associate is, but or if they're even still an associate, but I believe Father Stryker is still there for the Fathers of Mercy.
Okay. Now, can the devil fake a private revelation?
Yes. Very, very much can he. Matter of fact, it's the perennial teaching of the church that he can, and that's one of the reasons why she is very cautious, because the devil can fake things so much. Very, very true that the devil can certainly fake these things.
So how did you happen to write a book like this, Refractions of the Light?
Well, it was born from a lot of my own experience working with these areas. I've been involved in the church's theology of private revelation since about January of 2002. And actually, it's really about my becoming Catholic. It ultimately has roots in my conversion. I'll go on record and I'll tell you this story. This is a good one. This is my Jesus in the elevator story, okay? This is really, really cool. When my father was dying in the hospital in 1996, we went to go visit him on Ascension Thursday of May of 1996. So this would have been about the 16th or the 18th, of that year, or thereabouts. So my father was in a hospital in Boston, and my family and I went to go visit him that day. And I was the last one to go into the elevator, and I remember nobody was coming from the left or the right or behind me. I remember this. We go inside the elevator, and I go off to the left, and I turn around, and I'm kind of leaning up against the side there, and all of a sudden, this guy comes in, and goes and stands to the right, so he's standing almost exact opposite from me, in a straight line, and I get a good look at this guy, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this guy looks just like Jesus Christ. Any way you've ever pictured how Jesus has looked in artistry here in the West, this guy
mm-hmm.
has a spinning image, beard, the hair, I mean, you name it, this guy has it. And I was just like, oh my goodness. And I'm like, we're freaking out. Okay, in the middle of that elevator. I'm like, oh my goodness, what is going on? Mind you, I wasn't Catholic yet. I wasn't Catholic yet. And this is the really creepy part, okay? As I'm leaning up there, freaking out, I say, are you Jesus Christ? Instantly, on proper social cue, the guy looks right at me and nods his head.
Oh, my.
In a yes fashion.
Wow.
Okay, you want to talk about really freaking out? Now I'm really freaking out. Right after the elevator stops, he gets off. And it was just the creepiest thing. Now, here's the quirk of the story. My father was a janitor for what's now Verizon. This guy who looked like Jesus was dressed as a janitor. He had the mop and bucket. I think it was a red hat on and everything. I think the hair was tied back in a ponytail, if I remember correctly. And that wasn't the only time that happened. Sometime later, I was again visiting my father, and I was sitting in his room. And I had a clear shot to the hallway, clear visual to the hallway, and he was in a room, he was on a wing where there was a slight curvature. So, and my father, he was right at the inflex of the curve. My father was right there, thereabouts. And as I'm sitting there visiting my father, the janitor guy comes down the hallway, pushing or pulling a gurney, I don't remember which, with somebody else, and goes into a room right by my father's room. Again, I have a clear shot of the room. Nobody came in or out of that room after that incident. So I decided, I'm going to go, and this is me being the good little skeptical, the skeptic here.
Yeah.
That. So I go to that room. Nobody was there. Just poof.
Wow.
Gone. Now, I did one step even further. Some hospital rooms they share a bathroom, so they have adjoining rooms and they share a bathroom. I checked that bathroom. It was a private bathroom. The only way in and out of that room was that door or the window, which if you jumped out, you would have plummeted to your death.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody went in and out of that room after that room with the gurney. So for the past almost 21 years now, I've been convinced that I saw Jesus in an elevator and in the hospital hallway there.
Wow.
And so that was during the time when I was reading and studying and wanting to, you know, take these things more seriously. So, you know, I believe I've had my own personal experience. I don't push it on anybody else, you know, and say that you have to believe this or anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's my personal story. And so I've always kind of had an interest in these things. An eye for the mystical, if you will. And so
Okay. After
I became Catholic and went deeper into the theology of these things, it was just fascinating to me. And so I decided to put my findings down into a book.
That is a very interesting story. Thank you for sharing that. Back to fake private revelations. How do we tell if the devil is behind a private revelation?
I go back to that word caution. We have to be very, very careful because the devil is very, very seductive. The church very wisely does not micromanage us in these affairs, but the devil will oftentimes appear in various ways, but the one golden rule, according to St. Teresa of Avila, she taught that if somebody is so favored with these gifts authentically, they will increase in virtue. If they are not from God, these alleged revelations, the person, their life of virtue will suffer. And so we look at how they are living the life of virtue, and this requires extensive and very deep probing examinations. It's kind of like when the church is looking into the life a person has led because somebody's proposed them for beatification or canonization. The church guts this, the entire life of this person. every nook and cranny of this person will be known. Similarly, with respect to private revelation, that also will happen. This person will be vetted very, very strongly. In the old days, it used to be before the advent of like things like TV, radio, internet, Snapchat, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook and all them, it was more exclusively in the domain of the pastors of the church to do that kind of examination. But nowadays, with all this technology, people can go online and, I mean, you can do some of your own research for your own private discernment. And maybe communicate things privately to you know, circles of friends and stuff. I wrote an article about that called Angry Birds and Private Revelations after I was returning from Fatima, actually, in September of last year, and I was watching Angry Birds, the movie, on part of the in-flight movie, and I saw some themes in there. I was like, oh my goodness, this totally relates to private revelation. And I wrote an article and put it up on my website, kind of discussing some of those parallels.
Interesting. Now, this is an interesting question. Can the devil suggest people to enter the religious life through a private revelation?
Yes, indeed. I in my book I talk about this, and I get flack for this. People don't see how this could happen, but it's actually very, very simple. First of all, let me state anybody who is in the religious life or has at least discerned for a little while and then discerned out maybe during their novitiate, let's say, or anybody who has studied specific areas of church history, they will tell you that sometimes the devil wants to maybe destroy a community because maybe they have a lot of holy people there and he's looking to destroy it. And so he manages to send one of his agents, shall we say, into there to infiltrate and try to destroy it from within or otherwise create confusion, disruption, and things of that sort. I remember once I was visiting a monastery in Illinois, and I was talking with one of the monks there who was also an art teacher at their school, and we got to talking about this. And no sooner did we get talking on the subject, he was just like, oh, of course the devil can do stuff like that. Oh, good grief. Isn't it obvious? I was like, well, yes, to you and I, brother, but to others, maybe not. You know, the devil will certainly do that. And the way Thomas Aquinas writes about it is it's usually the devil will do that to have somebody do some work that he wants them to do. And oftentimes these people don't even know that they are at the suggestion that they're being manipulated by these forces. A lot of times they simply don't know. Other times they do. There was one case in the 1600s, I think, Sister Magdalena of the Cross. She was possessed. She had actually willfully consented to the machinations of the devil, and so she knew what she was doing. But sometimes it's a lot more subtle, and you won't always have that clarity. But succinctly, yes, the devil can suggest people to enter the religious life in order for them to accomplish some work he wishes them to do.
Now, talking about authentic private revelation, what are some of the fruits?
Okay, so do you mean fruits within the individual, like say the visionaries, or fruits as in on a broader scale of like people affected by apparitions, for instance?
Yeah. Let's look at both of them.
Okay. Well, the first one, with respect to the individual, it goes back to what I mentioned with St. Teresa of Avila. The one who grows in virtue is the one that you need to be looking at as having the more authentic revelations.
Yeah,
they bring
like
about
that.
An increase in humility, obedience, charity, as opposed to pride, disobedience, hatred or indifference, increase in virtue, leading you towards Jesus Christ and a deeper union with God, you have a good argument that this is authentic private revelation. Anything that leads you away from Christ, as Cardinal Ratzinger put it, the three theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity, that's bad. Very, very bad. And that's on the individual level. Now, on the on the more group level, like those influenced by a claim of apparitions, it generally speaks of the same thing. Are they growing closer to God or away from? If a devotion has been proposed, like, say, Fatima, you have the Five for Saturday devotion that was proposed by Our Lord and Our Lady. Is that bringing good fruit in people's lives? Are they increasing in virtue? Or are they becoming so obsessed or rigid or, I have to do this, or else I'm going to go to hell, or a thousand souls in purgatory won't be saved today if I don't do this sort of thing, you know. Now, of course, the soul in purgatory is good, but if you're getting so rigid about it, or you're getting apocalyptic, making some grand promises that don't come true, that's not good. Are you working people up?
And I think we've covered the fruits of an inauthentic private revelation.
Yes. I mean, volumes could be written, but in a nutshell, yes. Generally, that which leads you closer to God is of God. Not to say that if you're given a carte blanche, you always have to be careful even still, because the devil may give you 99% of the truth, that 1% about which you must be concerned. And anything that leads you away from God, in any way, even that one little percent, is not from God.
I've been taught a simple discernment technique, which is, is this something Jesus would say? Is this contrary to the Bible, or is it contrary to church teaching? And that covers a lot of that.
Those are the three bases. You got first, second, third base, and then you're taking them all. That's very good, simple, very good rule of thumb. Very good rule of thumb.
Right.
The caveat to that is, do people know the faith well enough to be able to point out and say, that doesn't sound right. Something's not right there. That's the caveat. So people have to educate themselves in the faith. And that's part of the fruits of these things. An authentic revelation leads you closer to God, closer to His church. You know,
right.
If you're more worried about what the latest message is, from the latest Johnny Come Lately onto the scene with all things visions, I always speak kind of loosely, and I apologize. I don't mean to be untoward, but if somebody's more worried about paying attention to the latest message coming from a visionary, alleged visionary, as opposed to saying what magisterium is, or reading those beautiful documents like the papal encyclicals, for instance, or the catechism, or something from the lives of the saints. You know, if you're worried about the latest vision, that's not healthy either. That actually betrays a lack of faith.
Yep. This book is very much needed.
Yes, I agree. But I'm biased, of course. But yes, it is very much needed, just to kind of help. If nothing else, just to help people get a sense of balance again in these otherwise very controversial issues.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that's Refractions of Light. Are there anything else you want to add?
There's a famous saying that is attributed to St. Padre Pio. It's pray, hope, and don't worry. You know, a lot of people may be worried about the times in which we live, and there are many reasons why we should be concerned. But if we hold fast to our faith, hold fast to God, the rest really just takes care of itself, and, you know, and catechize and evangelize and study and learn. If we're so preoccupied with the latest claims to visions, you might be mistaken the forest for the trees, and so we just pray, hope, and don't worry. I do not know if St. Padre Pio said that, in fact, but it's good advice nevertheless.
On the cover of one of his books, I think.
That's right, I saw it.
Okay, so what about your other book, Pope Leo XIII's Prayer to St. Michael?
Oh, yes. Well, I wrote a book about that, and it was published on or around the 21st or so of November of 2015. The purpose of that particular book was to discuss and examine a very famous story that Pope Leo XIII was said to have had a vision that led to him writing the prayer to St. Michael that used to be prayed at the end of Mass around the Catholic Church prior to the Second Vatican Council. There were so many different stories flying about that, versions about that story, and really about 05, 06, I said, that's when I kind of started noticing this a little bit more and doing a little research into the matter, and I found a couple of sources in particular, but I put it aside. I didn't do too much with it until May of 2012. I was getting back from a social outing with some people in South Carolina, and at the very end of which I was in a car, and we got to talking about the prayer to St. Michael, and one of the people with whom I was speaking with at the time was saying things that were not accurate, excuse me, and I knew that they were not accurate, and so I said, all right, that's it. I am going to start this up again. I'm going to look deeply into this and figure out what's going on. 216 pages later, and about 3 years of work in 7 foreign languages, Book Louis XIII and the Prayer to St. Michael came into being.
Wow. Beautiful. So these books are available at Amazon. I'm looking at the advertisement right now. It's beautiful. The beautiful cover on the Refractions of Light with the beautiful portrait of an eye, huh?
Yes. The designer, T.J. Burdick, I don't remember his company's name. He's going to kill me for that, and I apologize. But T.J. Burdick, he did a very good job, and I feel bad in some ways because I think I was a little picky with that particular cover because I was looking for a certain design. And if you look closely at the eye, you see an image of Our Lady of Guadalupe appear into it. And I was trying to go for a vision and somebody seeing, like looking up and seeing Our Lady in a vision, you know. And the cover for the Prayer to St. Michael, that was done by a gentleman, Andy Schmalen, out in Georgia. He used to work for EWTN. As soon as I saw his website, he recently redid his website, but when I saw his old website, some of his artwork, I said, this is the guy to do the book for the St. Michael, the cover for the St. Michael book. I just knew it, and I'm so glad that we did. It's beautiful, beautiful cover. Those gentlemen did very, very good work.
Tell us about the cover on the St. Michael book.
To explain the imagery? You mean,
yeah.
Okay, well, if somebody looks at the cover, they'll see St. Peter's. There's like a shade of dark there, and to the light, to the left, excuse me, they'll see St. Michael, the archangel, and to the right, they'll see a dragon representing the devil with fiery flames around him, and St. Michael is, you know, standing tall in the light of God there. First of all, you'll see it's the St. Peter's and the Piazza di San Pietro, as seen from the dome of St. Peter's there in Rome, at the Vatican City. The imagery goes, the darkness kind of it represents one of the themes of the book. It was a cardinal that talked from the Archdiocese of Bologna in Italy who talked about Leo's vision. He heard that Leo had a vision from Leo's private secretary, Monsignor Rinaldo Angeli. And the cardinal described briefly what he had heard from Angeli. And he talked about how Leo saw demons gathering upon Rome. The Italian word was Adensavano, which means, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, it's Adensavano, which means a thickening, literally. And so the darkness gathering, almost like blotting out the sun, represents the demons coming upon the eternal city there. and, of course, St. Michael on the left, devil on the right, they're duking it out they're duking it out, basically. So it gives that throwback to the prayer to St. Michael itself, which there's a line in there that talks about casting the devil and his angels back into hell, who prowls about the world seeking the ruin of souls. So that's generally the imagery behind the front cover of that particular book.
And joining us tonight, too, is Al Bielowski, who was the host of our program on Wednesday nights, which is called Catholic Mysticism. And so let's get right into it, Kevin. We're going to talk about Fatima and what happened at Fatima. So let's go.
All right. Well, Fatima is a place in Portugal where the Blessed Virgin Mary appeared to three shepherd children, Lúcia de Santos and her two cousins, Francisco and Jacinta Marto. These appearances took place primarily between May 13th through October 13th, 1917, though there were some later apparitions in connection with this set of appearances. During the course of the apparitions from May to October, Our Lady had promised to perform a miracle so that people may believe the children. They were persecuted and even imprisoned for their story. Despite the hardships that they had endured, the children never recanted. In October, Our Lady performed what is known as the Miracle of the Sun. It had been raining that day in October, during which the rain had stopped. The clouds had parted, allowing the sun to come through. And according to various witnesses, the sun defied all cosmic laws, allowing it to come through. And the sun came out of through the clouds there, moved out of its place in the sky, and different people described it differently. Some described it as the place of the dance of the sun, while some others have reported that the sun began falling to the earth. After the miracle had ended, the ground and people's clothing were completely dry. And for the next 13 years to the day, the church examined the facts of the case, including the visionaries, and then concluded in 1930 that the events of 1917 were supernatural in origin. Since then, both local clergy and even popes have endorsed Fatima as worthy of belief, some even going so far as to say that the church feels compelled to believe in Fatima only simply to how prophetic it is.
Okay. Now, we've heard that there was a secret given to the visionaries at Fatima. Maybe you could tell us about that.
Sure. During Our Lady's apparition of July 13th, 1917, she communicated some information to the three visionaries. This information was referred to as a secret by the visionaries because during its communication, Our Lady had ordered that the information not be shared with anyone other than themselves. Later, however, between the years 1935 and 1944, Lúcia, who by this time was the only surviving visionary and had become a religious sister, began to write down in more detail the events of 1917. Under religious obedience, she wrote down in stages the information given to the three visionaries as a secret from July 1917. Sister Lúcia described the secret as having three parts, the first two of which were written down and published by 1942, well, I'll say by the end of that year. They entailed a vision of hell and devotion to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. The third part remained unwritten until early January 1944, when, after a subsequent apparition of Our Lady, and having been commanded to do so, Sister Lúcia wrote down what she saw in July 1917 for the third part of the secret. This text was unpublished from 1944 to 2000, during which time occurred much speculation and theorizing on its contents. Owing to a stipulation given by Sister Lúcia, the text had been expected to be published or otherwise revealed in the year 1960, but this expectation was not met, which furthered the speculations and theorizing. Eventually, the text was published officially on June 26, 2000, during a press conference in Rome. The text revealed that the secret was a visualization of Our Lady's words about what would happen if her requests were not heeded, namely that there would be wars and persecutions of the Church, the people would be martyred, the Holy Father would have much to suffer, and various nations would be annihilated.
Now, I understand you're writing a book about Fatima. And tell us about that.
Yes, I am writing a book. It's called On the Third Part of the Secret of Fatima. I just finished basically the final drafts here on my part. I just submitted it to the publisher on Root Books and Media yesterday or Wednesday, one of those 2 days. And so now I'm just looking forward to it going through the formal editing with the professional editor and then getting that back and submitting it to the imprimatur. And hopefully it will be ready by mid-2019. 2017 in time for the centenary of Fatima.
Wow. And why write a book about the third part of The Secret of Fatima?
I decided to write this book owing to the earlier mentioned speculations and theories surrounding the third part of The Secret. Over the past 57 years, if we go by the date of the expected release of the text in 1960, different persons and groups have offered their understanding and interpretation of Fatima and the third part of its secret. Various characterizations have arisen on this part of the secret, some of which have grossly misunderstood, unfortunately, the overall secret of Fatima. It is true that room exists for scholarly and charitable discussion on the meaning of Fatima and its secret. Unfortunately, however, not everyone has kept to a gentlemanly standard, shall we say, when holding such discussion, and those who have not held to a gentlemanly standard have oftentimes engaged in polemics and have even gone so far as to accuse the Holy See of a conspiracy to cover up an alleged second text of the third part of the secret. This allegation has become infamously known as the Fourth Secret of Fatima. My book, is an attempt at addressing this matter from a critical perspective, one that examines source material and recasts it in the light of new evidence that only recently became available to the public. The intention of this book is not to answer definitively all of the issues that could be raised, or have been raised. I do hope, however, that it will mark the beginning of an end to these controversies, so that we can look forward to what I believe is an exciting new period of Fatima's history, one that is marked by further study of the life and character of Sister Lucia. I believe that such a study will provide a critical interpretive key on the message of Our Lady at Fatima.
Now, what would you say is the heart of the message of Fatima?
Good question. Very, very debatable question. Many respected ecclesiastical authorities and scholars, shall we say, have rendered their opinion on this question. Some hold that it is the devotion to Our Lady's Immaculate Heart. Others believe it is the message of prayer, penance, and sacrifice. For my part, I have not had to look at this question too deeply for the purposes of my book. I have, however, come across it, especially materials related to Chapter 11 of my book. I render my opinion on this matter in some detail in that chapter, Chapter 11. For now, I think it's probably best to say that Fatima is intimately rooted in the call of Jesus Christ and the Holy Gospel for mankind to conversion. The path, it must be noted, of this conversion is where the crux of the present question is, and I leave the details for readers when my book is published later this year.
Now, what do you hope that people will learn from reading your book then?
I think that in the end, what I hope people will learn from my book is the beauty of Fatima. Assuming the endless controversies involving the third part of the secret have, in my opinion, done a lot of damage to understanding the call of Our Lady in Fatima. Anger, bitterness, distrust, and seeking of pretexts have all been engendered in not a few people. And these things are not those to which Our Lady called her children. She called upon her children to be witnesses to her son in an age of godlessness and a rampant pervasive materialism that offers comforts to humanity to the neglect of its God. Mankind strives after his technology, even at the point of harnessing the power of the sun to nuclear and fusion energy and all that scientific stuff, you know, of which I don't know, much about, but in general. But nevertheless, what I do know is that because of Fatima, God reminds us through his Holy Mother, the miracle of the Son, that he is Lord and God, not us. The Lady came to Fatima as Pope Benedict XVI taught in May 2010. She came as a prophet to tell us of the sweet joys of God. And I hope that my book will serve to refocus people on the heart of Our Lady's call, not to be preoccupied with controversies and to be attentive to the real needs of our times.
So, Al, what do you think?
I've got to tell you, Kevin, I want to congratulate you because this book, I think, is so important now. And what you mentioned about the division and the controversies with the third secret, because I've run into this quite a bit, and you're absolutely right. Many people think that there's some kind of hidden agenda here by the popes, plural, and the Vatican. And the truth of the matter is it's not so. the consecration, that was valid, and this division, which certainly the Lord doesn't want, I think it's timely for this book and to end that kind of controversy. You know, I run into people, as I've mentioned, and some of the things that these are just personal insights and not scholarly, but growing up in my lifetime, I'm 60 years old now, if anybody would have told me when I was, say, 15 to 30, that I would have saw the Our Lady of Fatima statue on a procession in Red Square in Moscow, I would have laughed in their face. I see, like it or not, with all the media attention to Vladimir Putin, there's an argument that could be made right now in the public sector and their educational sector in Russia that right now they have more religious freedom than the United States. There, for example, in their school systems are taught evolution but creationism, and then it's up to the student to decide which course of action there they want to choose to believe in. Their patriarchs for the Orthodox religion bless their military equipment, and Vladimir Putin right now is using taxpayer dollars to rebuild the churches that were destroyed under the Stalinist regime. So there's a lot of things that are pointing to, and I think a book, especially with our nation right now and the division in our own country that we see so prevalent, I think this is very timely for this book to come out, certainly during the 100-year anniversary, to get unity back. So kudos to that.
Thank you. Yes, and that is part of the aim. Is I wrote this with the centenary of Fatima in mind, for sure. Yes, there's a lot of happenings right now in Russia. And I honestly don't know what to make of it all. I don't have enough intel. Recently, I participated in the 24th Mariological Congress, which is a Roman conference, but it was hosted in Fatima back in September. And I met a priest who lived in Russia, and I had an opportunity to talk to him in the old Fatima Basilica that was built in the 1950s. And he had mentioned to me that anything that you're hearing, or I don't think he said anything, he said everything, that you're hearing in the Western media about Putin, he said it's all a lie. He said it's all a lie. He said Putin is actually a very godly man who's doing what he can to uphold Judeo-Christian values, Christian civilization. But then later on that day, I spoke to somebody who used to work at the Vatican, who turned around and said, I don't think that that's entirely true, and here's why. So there's two different schools of thought. I honestly don't have enough information to be able to make an informed judgment at this time, but I do look at the political situation, and I keep my fingers on it, the pulse, as it were, to some degree, and, you know, I have enough there to scratch my head thinking, oh my goodness, what is going on here? This is crazy. But Sister Lucia once said about, my book doesn't treat the question of was the consecration done or not in 1984, but there is a video, I'm actually going to say this live, there is a video on record of Sister Lucia, basically, from what I can tell, of her admitting that the consecration in 1984 was valid, that it took effect, and that it was accepted in heaven. I have seen this video. Somebody asked her, how will we know the effect of it? And not in the video, but elsewhere, in another context, she had said, look to the east, almost like Gandalf in Lord of the Rings. When the sun rises, look to the east, you know, and then you'll know my coming. You know, and you see Gandalf coming down with the riders of Rohan, going down and killing off the army of Mordor there, or Saruman's army there. You know, you got to wonder, you really do. I don't know one else, so I don't make any definitive statement, but I do see things happening on the political landscape that give me pause and to make me think and or give me hope.
Well, thank you, Kevin. And anything else you want to add about the book? And you said it'll probably be out sometime later this year? Or
yes,
later
I'm
next
hoping,
year?
I'm hoping middle of next middle by May or June of 2017, but that depends upon the review and processes and all that.
Right. Okay, well, thank you for being with us and telling us about this very exciting book. And thank you, Al. Any final thoughts from you, Al?
One question, if Kevin has the time. You know, Kevin, also in my travels, a lot of people are confused and ask about, if you could expound upon, what is the triumph of the Immaculate Heart that was promised in Fatima?
Yes, I treat that to some degree at the end of one of my chapters, not in any great length, but there are two different schools of thought on that question, as there often are. One school of thought holds that there's going to be this little triumph, the Immaculate Heart things are basically, it kind of holds that there's going to be this instantaneous conversion, everybody is going to be Catholic, or at least Russia will become Catholic, and almost as if like God's going to wave a magic wand over the world and all the problems are just going to go away. However, others have taken some exception to that, including Cardinal Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI, now of course Pope Emeritus. And in an interview, he stated that, I don't really think that that's going to be the way of it. I might be a bit too rational to believe it's going to happen that dramatically, he says. But he takes more of a simple approach, which is the same approach that he took in his theological commentary from the year 2000 that accompanied the release of the third part of the secret in there on June 26th of that year, 2000. He said that basically what it's going to come down to is Our Lady will triumph in the hearts of individual people, and from that triumph in the hearts of individual people, that's what will lead to conversion on a larger scale. So he's just trying to point out that conversion happens within all of us initially, and from there, that's when it spreads. And I think there's merit to that. If I have to say which of the two schools of thought I tend to agree with the most, I think Ratzinger has a good argument there. Not necessarily to the exclusion of the other one, because if everybody runs the way of God's commandments, that is, through the Immaculate Heart of Mary, as she offered at Fatima, the more people you have living that, you're going to have a better society, and you're going to have that conversion happening automatically. So I don't think that they're necessarily exclusive schools, but they just may have to fine-tune each other a little bit, perhaps.
Very good, Kevin. Thank you very much for being with us again. And we've been talking about your book on the third part of The Secret of Fatima. Like you say, we'll be coming out in June or July. And Al, thank you for being with us. And that's our program for tonight. I thought you'd like to know this, too. So it was very revealing, wasn't it, Al?
Yes, it was. And, Kevin, thank you so much for the work you're doing, and God and the Holy Spirit continue to bless you and your family. And have a great 2017.
Thank you very much. You guys, too.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. And in the meantime, we'll see you next week, same time, same station. In the meantime, God bless each and every one of you. In Jesus' name, amen.
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 We hope you enjoyed the program and will join us back for another show on WCAT Radio. This is Sebastian Mahfood. Good day.